Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We most recently talked about The Hateful Eight. I don't remember what we talked about before it, but oh, it was Star Wars, and a variety of things before that, given that this is episode like 240 or 241, something like that. So yeah, check that out, themacguffinman.com. Follow us on Twitter for very sporadic updates as to what we are talking about. And yeah, I'll probably be posting something on the website next week about Carol and Joy and Jennifer Lawrence and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, let's get to the episode here.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We have trundled back through the Canadian wilderness to record this podcast.
That's right.
Our lives have been changed. We learned a lot.
Uh-huh.
We learned a lot about nature.
Finally, we might get our podcasting Oscar on this
one. We might. Like, it's gonna be a legacy award, but I think we're going to get it. We've done this for 5 years. We've earned it.
Yeah. We are clearly talking about The Revenant today. One that I think we decided to do as soon as we heard about this project.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
You touched on the issue of Oscars and legacy Oscars already.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a lot of what people are talking about when they talk about this movie, mm-hmm. is Leo's desire for an Oscar. Yeah. We'll get to that, I bet.
Yeah.
how did you feel about this movie?
I liked it. Was not crazy about it. Like I enjoy it. It's very beautiful to look at, and you know, it's a pretty simple little action movie, and I enjoyed that. I think its attempts to be meaningful than I think it actually is are kind of hinder it. But I liked it. I mean, it's a movie that pretty shamelessly rips off Terrence Malick and Cormac McCarthy. So obviously I was like, even if you're not doing it well, if you're just doing it well enough, you know, I'm on board, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the kind of technical mastery with less meaning than it believes it has is something I think we both landed on with Birdman as well, by the same director.
Yeah, yeah. Before we get to that, I want to know what you feel about The Revenant.
Oh, I actually think I am in pretty much the same boat as you on this one. I kind of just assumed you were going to like this a lot more, and maybe mm-hmm. that came across in some of the pre-recording emails I sent you. Mm-hmm. there are things that I loved a lot and things that I really didn't like, and I still think I'm kind of split on it. I've seen it twice. I don't think I'll ever love it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
this is like, if you're going to love this movie, you're going to love it the first time you see it.
Yeah, it's not really a slow burn, is it?
No.
I think what this movie offers, yeah, as you said, it offers right away. And there are parts of this movie that are absolutely stunning. I mean, visually, obviously, it's gorgeous, as you said.
The vast majority of this movie is visually stunning.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I think the sound design is also something that was completely incredible in this movie, too.
100% agree.
And Tom Hardy, I thought, was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And it might surpass Bane as the Tom Hardy impression I wish I could do perfectly. And won't even attempt because obvious reasons. And then there are some things that I really didn't like. And I think you touched on a big one where it's pretty simple, which is fine, but it certainly doesn't believe it's pretty simple, which is less fine.
Yeah, which is, yeah, exactly. And I know that's a weird line, but I think it's pretty, I don't know, I feel like with this movie especially, I feel like we can really, like, people understand what we mean by this movie feeling like it's more important than it is. You know, I feel like that really bleeds through in the movie, you know?
Yeah, well, can you try to unpack that a little bit in case that's not clear?
It's so tricky, though. Because I don't know. Like, I don't know. Well, I think part of it is Leonardo DiCaprio is in this movie, right?
So it comes pretty loaded. Like, I mean, and it's Oscar bait. I mean, it's the director of of Birdman. I mean, the last year's Best Picture winner.
Last year's Best Director winner, right?
Oh, is it?
Did he win last year?
I don't know.
I'm going to look it up. You can keep talking.
Yeah, and I mean, Leo, as we discussed, you know, Oscar potential for a long time now.
Yeah, one director.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it's gorgeous. A lot of talented people involved. And you know,
Emmanuel Lubezki, two-time cinematography winner. Stephen Mirion, I believe, edited it. He's an Oscar-winning editor. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it just people had high hopes for it. Leonardo DiCaprio just doesn't touch little projects anymore, for better or worse.
And he hasn't been in anything since The Wolf of Wall Street. He also just, in general, doesn't act all that frequently. So, and like really values the level of import that he brings to a project. Like it's like you said, you know, he doesn't do little things anymore. I mean, he never really did, you know, it was always true. Like, as soon as he got established enough to pick his own roles, it was just, he's always been very cautious about what he attaches himself to. And, if you look at his track record, like there are a lot of movies that he's in that I'm not crazy about, but, it's always very easy to see a very smart reason as to why he chose to be in that movie, you know? And yeah, I don't know, like just his presence in a movie kind of lends it a general, like a level of importance that is odd. And especially since I'm not Leo's biggest fan, you know, like that I still attach that to these movies, you know, just because he's there.
Yeah, and the list of directors who he has worked with now, it keeps getting bigger and more prestigious. As much as I loved when he showed up on SNL, I was very much surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not something that's going to reduce your credibility or anything. It's not the big artistic choice to, like every movie selection, as you said he is now. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, he just had kind of is one of the few legitimate movie stars that we have left. I mean, there's just that kind of gravity about everything that he does. And certainly this movie also brings many other elements that contribute to that. But anyway, kind of getting back to what we were saying about it being simple. I mean, it's artistic. I mean, it's a kind of just a survival / revenge story. Mm-hmm. There's not a ton in it that happens that isn't predictable, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, there are still a lot of very, very enjoyable things about it, but it's supposed to just be a somewhat straightforward story. You know, but just handled with extreme care and extreme talent, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's what it is. Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah,
yeah.
So anyway, yeah. Can you get back to, or are you out of why this is a movie that takes it seriously? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the way Alejandro González Iñárritu, who is the director of this film, talks about it in interviews, also lends it that, you know, like even yeah. more like he. It's kind of just the way that he talks about his movies in general. Although I guess I don't have a lot of experience with listening to him talk about his movies pre-Birdman. But he's a very passionate guy and really gets behind. Not that, you know, I mean, pretty much every film director is, because to make a film, especially at this level, you have to be willing to basically dedicate 2 years of your life to it, you know?
Yeah.
But like outwardly passionate, you know? You know, there's David Fincher passionate, where he's just sitting in a chair and not moving and talking. And then there's Quentin Tarantino passionate, where he's like physically shaking and like shaking his hands while he talks. Iñárritu is the second of those, you know, like he's just very he's going to tell you what he feels about his movie, and he feels a lot about his movie, you know. And I think the way he has talked about the land that they shot on and the getting in touch with nature and stuff has sort of lended that to it. And I think part of things that are actually in the movie that sort of attach that element is something that we can find in Birdman as well. The things that sort of break from the narrative structure of the movie. In Birdman, there was that shot of like the marching band and the comet at the beginning or whatever. And
every time you saw Birdman.
Oh, yeah, good point. But even like the appearance of Birdman didn't break from the one take structure of the movie, whereas these were cuts in Birdman, you know, so like even more removed from
right.
But anyway, and there's more of that in The Revenant with the dream sequences, because you just in Birdman you just get a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end, from what I recall, and dream sequences and sort of like the more mystical stuff that exists in The Revenant that is always going to make it seem like you want your movie to be seen as more important, like just by adding something that is you know, not realistic, something that
yeah,
can't happen.
It's
know?
Pure style, like the woman floating.
Yeah,
the,
exactly.
The bird coming out of the chest, which we assume it didn't happen.
I love the bird coming out of the chest, though. That's one thing I really
love. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why does that work?
Because it's something that is done so frequently terribly, like a character dies or something and a bird flies by on screen. Like I was just walking through the living room last night and my roommate was watching what I suspect was the series finale of Sons of Anarchy. And
spoilers.
Oh, who gives a shit? I don't think anybody listening to this podcast is a passionate Sons of Anarchy fan. But anyway, Jax is like riding his motorcycle and being followed by a ton of cops, and it's a musical montage or whatever. And it seems like it's the end scene of him, and the camera pans up to show a crow fly away, you know, and it's like, yeah. But there's no actual physical connection, and movies and shit do that all the time. I mean, not all the time, obviously that's hyperbole, but the bird coming out of the chest in this movie, I felt was something that's done a lot, but they did it differently. And I think that makes it way more effective. And I thought it was cool because it was new. It was a new old thing, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what I liked about that.
As far as something that is stylish, do you put Leo looking into the camera at the end of the movie in that category?
Well, yeah. Because, I mean, you're breaking the fourth wall. I fucking hated it so much.
And that was part of it. And that's part of kind of why I think I was so split on this movie, because it starts off so well. I mean, you couldn't do that for a whole movie, not just because it wouldn't be a movie if it was just a long action sequence like that. Mm-hmm. But it's so stunning. It was so well put together, so well shot. And I mean, kind of the first attack. I know there's a little bit before that, but
yeah.
That's kind of the first memorable thing.
The prologue's really good too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 But I mean, that first the first attack by the Ree when they're on the river and they gotta load up the pelts and things like that. I mean, it's just, it really grabs you. And so right away, you know, I was really into the movie and I thought it was great. And then throughout, there's some ups and downs. And then the ending, I hate the look at the camera. It's such a, like an exclamation mark, you know, like, didn't we make you think about something? And in the most kind of self-congratulatory way. I mean, I have a big problem with it. I know you would too. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but
you never are. I know everything.
Yeah, no, it's just such a, this is a serious movie moment that it introduces nothing new. It's not thought-provoking in any meaningful way. The only thought I get is, oh, fuck, you really made a poor filmmaking decision here. Mm-hmm. I have to mention this at one point anyway. Part of my struggling with how I feel about this movie, I asked my brother Colin and our frequent shout-out person, John Alistair.
Frequent shout-out person.
Yeah.
It's his job title on his business cards.
Yeah. I just wanted more opinions, because you and I don't really talk about the movies too much before we discuss them on the podcast. And, you know, I asked them for some opinions. So I want to thank them for giving me a lot of ideas about it. Mm-hmm. But I was really like just struggling with how I felt about this movie. And I know I do like certain things and I know I dislike certain things, but I just really couldn't quite place it. And you're better about, let's say, formulating hard opinions than I am. to put it delicately.
I do have thoughts, and I believe those thoughts to be 100% true 100% of the time. Go on.
Yeah, and I mean, that was just one where, I mean, it just bookends this movie. It starts so well, and it ends so poorly. And that's not to say that this movie is a steady decline in quality, because mm-hmm. that's not the case. And it's not that I just got sick of it, or it gets sloppier as it goes on, but that's a perfect summation about this movie for me, is that if we look at how it starts and how it ends, and it could have started horribly and ended perfectly, maybe I would still have the same opinion, but it rubbed me so much the wrong way. And for that to be the impression that you get left with, I think is pretty detrimental. So maybe that affected it, my opinion strongly negatively.
Okay. So let's say, the movie ends as it does, but Leo never looks at the camera, and we just cut to black in that same shot. Do you still not like the ending of this movie?
I like it a lot more. I like it a lot more. Mm-hmm. I mean, the theme of, you know, revenge is in God's hands. You know, that's said very explicitly, word for word, I believe, 2 points in this movie. I'm fine with that. You know, I think that's good. It's not the newest idea in the world, but, you know, all art doesn't have to be groundbreaking in every way. And kind of tackling timeless themes is can be very, very successful for a piece of art. And, you know, just kind of that giving back to nature, you know, the body just kind of floats away, and he's done. I mean, Leo or Glass, I'm going to call him Leo so much because
that's fine.
He's always Leo. Yeah. You know, the body floating away to be scalped by the natives, and, you know, Leo's kind of done with it. And I think there's that feeling for him of, I think it's a pretty empty bit of vengeance. You know, I think that he expected that to be a bit more rewarding than it was. And, you know, I think that says something important about vengeance and just that kind of frontier justice of killing someone who has wronged you.
Yeah, it's thirst quenching.
Yeah, it's I think that was fine. And then even if he stared, like, it's crazy. It's 2 inches if he had just stared to the side of the camera, yeah, and kind of lets that moment breathe for a bit, and you kind of reflect on everything I was just discussing, or, you know, or whatever you took away from the ending. But then he looks right at the camera for a few seconds. And, you know, I even like the way that it cuts to black and we still get the sound of his breathing.
It does not cut to black. It fades to black.
Yes. Fades to black. And you still get the breathing, and there's still, like, kind of that moment of this, you know, it's such labored breathing, the way that, you know, everything after the bear attack, he has a hard time breathing, has a hard time talking. It's still, to me, that breathing after in the darkness, it's the suffering continues. You know, you don't kill someone and then everything's fine. Obviously, your son's not coming back. Obviously, you still have a lot of things to struggle with.
Which is something that Tom Hardy mentions right before he dies, basically. Like,
yeah.
I hope you enjoy your revenge because your son's not coming back.
Yeah. And, you know, I think,
which is also a totally badass line to say as you're about to die.
Absolutely. I love Tom Hardy in this, but
I love Tom Hardy full stop. Like, and especially like
cut to black.
Well, yeah, exactly. No fades. Well, like, and I mean, there have been things that I've seen him in where he's kind of annoyed me. The drop specifically coming to mind. I think he has just found his comfort zone. And like specifically this year, I thought he was so goddamn good in Mad Max. And he's so good in The Revenant. I think Tom Hardy is like, it's like Oscar Isaac and then Tom Hardy to me, you know? Like, I just love watching him perform at this point.
Well, and I think all of our main actors in this, I think, do a very good job. The younger guy who's with Fitzgerald the whole time is great. Mm-hmm. And, Donald Gleason, I think, is also fantastic in this.
Yeah.
Playing a role I would never picture him in,
mm-hmm.
and doing a very good job of it.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you feel about the ending, other than the stare? You asked me.
Oh, I like the ending. I think the climactic action sequence is awesome. Huge.
Why?
Fan. It's just so enjoyable to watch. I like the corpse being propped up, and I really like the shot where they cut to Leo like revealing himself and shooting Tom Hardy.
And
I know it's not a knife fight specifically, but knife versus axe fight, I'm on board.
And those kind of brought me a few moments that I hadn't anticipated, you know, like I think when he cuts his finger off in that fight is really good, and like mm-hmm. gets a really good jump out of everybody. I mean, I saw this movie when I saw it in theaters, that the initial attack that we discussed before, I think that really gets people for obvious mm-hmm. reasons. I mean, those arrows just come in so quickly, and you kind of only see that one guy walk back to the fort naked before mm-hmm. You understand that shit is about to go down in a very serious way. But one thing in that scene I don't like is, you know, all of our people, all the faces you recognize, everyone around them is getting shot so often and so horribly, and they're fine. You know, I think that kind of speaks to one of my problems with this movie about kind of predictability and unrealistic in certain ways that really upset me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was true for you at all.
No, because I kind of, I don't know, maybe I just didn't. Yeah, I guess I just knew what this movie was going to be, and anything that would have changed from that would have been a pleasant surprise, but nothing did, and it didn't upset me, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've made it pretty clear that we like this movie, but it doesn't do everything right all the time, and that's I think, can play to the predictability thing. Like, it does a lot of stuff well enough that I don't care that it's a very simple, predictable story.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of the things this movie does very well? Because I think, you know, we've kind of glazed over that it's very gorgeous and has good sound, but I think that can be extrapolated a bit.
Okay. Well, let's start with the visuals, I suppose. So, shot by Emmanuel Lubezki. General total G.
These are all film terms. I don't know if you'll hear
film terms. Wide lens, total G. So well shot, and you know, not all like in long takes like Birdman was, but the philosophy of shoot in a long take whenever possible exists here. They just try and do things without cuts whenever possible, and there are a lot of times where there are cuts that they try and hide.
And you'll do a really long take followed. I mean, I'm speaking about that opening action sequence again. You get a really long take, and then sometimes those are so showy that, you know, those are really central, and then everything around it is smaller. We get these really long takes. We get Leo and Hawk, you know, hearing this fight start, and then we go back to just another long take. Like that little scene's in there for you know, narrative purposes to show, you know, he heard, now he's coming back, but really that scene could not, like, it, you could take it out and we're still just dealing with these two amazingly choreographed sequences. Mm-hmm. And some of these shots, I mean, we have got things. I was watching it the second time and just watching things in the background, and none of it's amiss. Like, there's still fighting and all these things happening in the background that you don't get a chance to see the first time. And if you watch it again and you pay attention to it, it's still immaculate. It all looks like, just if you look for flaws, it's almost impossible to find. Maybe there'll be one in there. But I thought all the stuff in the background still looked good. All the stuff in the foreground is great. And just to time all these people and the way that it all comes together, even with, you know, a horse running at full speed, timing that perfectly with some of these camera movements and all the other blocking, it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Agreed entirely. And also, even in some of the conversation scenes, like, they shot this movie, as far as I can tell, entirely on wide lenses. Like, I think the longest lens they use in this movie is a 28 millimeter, which is very wide. And so what they did was, even with close-ups, they're using wide-angle lenses. And so in order to get your close-up with a wide-angle lens, the camera has to be right in the actor's face. And I think you can, I mean, there's that shot. Leo has crawled over to his dead son and he's lying, like resting his head on him. The camera's so close that he's fogging up the lens with his breath. Like, that's real, because the camera has to be that close to get that shot of Leo because yeah. of the lens choices they've made. And that's because Manuel Bezki feels like the wide angle lens is more immersive. Like, it just gives you a stronger feel for the environment that you're in. And another thing that's impressive about how they do that is that in some of these conversations, like some of these long take conversations that exist in the movie, there are some Steadicam moves where we've got a wide shot where we've got a couple people talking and say Leo is in the back loading his rifle, right? While Tom Hardy and Donal Gleason are talking. And so we've got a two shot of Donal Gleason and Tom Hardy, and then we sort of get up right in Tom Hardy's face for a close-up, come back to the two, go back into Donal Gleason's face for a close-up, and then back to the wide, and then through or around those two over to Leo, who's loading his rifle, and get a close-up of him. So the camera has to move so much, and it's so hard to keep, you know, to do all that staging. And it's really impressive. And it's, even in the more subtle moments of this movie, the cinematography is still really impressive, you know?
Yeah, and I think that it's easy to see how, you know, complicated those things are in those big action sequences. But as you just said, I mean, the way that it's so smooth and fluid and just a conversational thing, and just that conversation you're just talking about when they're deciding to store the pelts and they're kind of on that, you know, cliff edge or whatever you would say. Mm-hmm. That shot just goes on for so long, and there's just such easier ways to shoot this over the shoulder, but they just choose to do it with one camera. And yeah, I that's immersive to me too, just the way that he said the choice of the wide lenses too. I think you just pay no attention to these cuts and things like that, because they're not there. We're just having, you know, you feel like you're part of this conversation, and you look at whoever's talking, and you know, it's just the camera's kind of functioning the way that your eye would if you were there as part of that party. And it's just it just feels so natural. And
yeah, and that cliff edge conversation scene is another good example of them hiding cuts, because when Tom Hardy loads up a pelt on the horse or moves some sort of bag in front of the camera, I forget, it's just this very large blocky thing, when he moves that in front of the camera, I'm just about certain they're hiding a cut there, you know. And it's just like, it's a way for them to break up the scene but also still have the same shot, you know. And that one is especially smooth. Like, there are some that are a bit more jagged throughout the movie.
And you maintain that sense of immersion when you do it like that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's just something goes in front of the camera, it's black for a split second, and you know, you and I are watching this critically, and a lot of other people, but if you can just sit there and watch the movie for a story that, you know, you don't even pick that up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And anything else visually? I want to ask you about natural light, because they made a big deal about using almost all natural light for this movie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Obviously gorgeous, and especially that they shot so much of the movie at magic hour as well, which, I mean, it's got magic in the name, so like, it looks great. But excuse me, that's another little bit of Malick thievery. Like, every time
shooting 2 hours a day and pissing off your whole crew but making a very good product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Malick has been shooting with all natural light, I mean, pretty much since he started making movies, you know. And you know, not that he only ever uses natural light. Like, Days of Heaven is a movie from the 70s that semi-famously shot almost entirely at magic hour as well. And, you know, Emmanuel Lubezki has been Terrence Malick's cinematographer since The New World, which is another movie that shot, as far as I can tell, like, almost exclusively in natural light. It's been a long time since I've read about that movie, but that's what I recall being part of the idea. But yeah, it's always impressive. And the thing that makes it so impressive is that you're able to make something this gorgeous with the fact that you are not able to move the light. You know, it's like it takes a certain resourcefulness. And because the sun, you know, if you want the gaffer to move the sun a little bit, the gaffer can't move the sun, you know? So, yeah, it's just this total sort of resourcefulness that you need. And it's really impressive that you can do it, if you can do it. And especially with Magic Hour, like nobody has ever been able to successfully replicate Magic Hour, as far as I know, other than naturally, you know, like you just do it live, you know, that's how you have to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that brings me to a question I want to ask. I mean, you're saying that it is impressive and I can, you know, try to imagine just how difficult and frustrating it can be and how talented you have to be to, you know, get all these shots, have all these things work out in the right place. I mean, we talked about how complicated, you know, some of the blocking and choreography and timing of shooting these things is. Visually, what's the benefit? I mean, I am appreciating the fact that it's a hard thing to do, mm-hmm. but why do it if it's so hard? I imagine something shows up, but what is it that, why go to all this trouble? What is it that people like so much about natural light, whether they know that that's what they're liking about it or not?
I think it's just a naturalism, right? And just this sort of imperceptible or indescribable naturalism that it adds to a movie, right? Like, Terrence Malick shoots that way because if you watch any of his movies, he is just fascinated by all of the various mysteries of nature. And he understands that nature is uncontrollable. And I think that's a thing that runs through this movie as well. And yeah. The choice to use uncontrollable light also sort of augments that. It's just that you feel like you're in a more realistic setting. And even if you can't necessarily point it out as to why, you just feel like you're in a more realistic setting, which then augments the fact that this movie is about nature, you know, as well. So
yeah, and that's a cool, just, you know, meta thematic thing. You know, so much of this movie is obviously about a man struggling against nature. Mm-hmm. So to have a man directing a movie about a man struggling against nature, to get that light and everything, I think is cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And on that note, do you, I wanted to ask you also about, you know, just this idea of suffering for your product. I mean, it's obviously Glass, Leo goes through a serious struggle against nature in this one, but very famously, Leo, you know, did a lot of this stuff and was very cold and ate raw meat and things like that.
And he's a vegan too, I think. So,
oh yeah. So he's got that added struggle to eating raw meat. It's done a few things. It's added to the narrative of Leonardo DiCaprio being desperate for the Oscar, which is
let's be polite to Leo for one time. Leonardo Craftsman, you know.
Okay, I wanted your take on this kind of style of acting, and I'm not saying he, you know, I'm not biting on this whole meme of him doing everything he does in order to get an Oscar. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he wants one, but he has.
We all know he desperately wants one.
Yeah, I feel like he has other motivations, and I feel like if he already had one, I can see him doing this movie and doing everything he did for this movie. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Leo Craftsman.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, what do you think of this? You know, acting when it isn't acting. You know, if you are that cold, if you need to play someone being very cold to get very cold, and mm-hmm. just the idea of the Leo Oscar desperation in general. And if you've seen the gif of him crawling in this movie with the Oscar constantly moving out?
I have not seen that.
Okay, well, now you have.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You can picture it, yeah.
So, as far as, like, the eating bison liver or whatever, I think acting in general, and, you know, there are people that will do that type of stuff, and, like, Daniel Day-Lewis would have killed the bison himself and then eaten the liver, you know? Like, there are people that will do these things because they think it helps them maintain sort of the facade of them being this character, right? And what acting is all about is imagining that this unreal world that you are a part of is real, right? So anything that you can do to stop yourself from breaking that facade or stop other people from breaking that facade is very important. Like, remember in I guess it would have been 2008 or early 2009 when that tape of Christian Bale yelling at the director of photography on Terminator Salvation came out?
Yes.
So,
and I yelled, "We're done professionally," for 3 years straight. Yes, I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's a good thing we don't get paid for this. Otherwise, you screw it up every week.
I wouldn't scream, "You're a nice guy," but yes, continue.
Okay, so that happens on the set of Terminator Salvation, which is an even more unreal movie than The Revenant, much more so. Yes. And so what Christian Bale has to do, and again, Christian Bale, very serious actor, I think we would both agree, very talented actor, and he is now lending his post-Batman gravitas to, like, keep in mind, the movie he came from before doing Terminator Salvation was The Dark Knight, right? So it's a very quick-moving set. Nolan is known to move quickly. And two, it was, after Pulp Fiction, like, the most influential American movie post-1990, you know?
And, inarguably the movie of a subgenre, but still.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he is coming from a certain place and then going to a McG movie, right? So he's slumming it.
Which actually is a real film term because there is a director named McG.
Yeah. So, you know, it's already going to be hard enough for him to keep up the idea that he is John Connor in the war against the machines. And then somebody in his eye line is moving and fucking with a light or whatever. And he freaks out because he's already up against basically impossible odds. And, somebody moving in his eye line that's a director of photography, like specifically there to photograph the scene, it ruins his concentration. It ruins the idea in his head that he could be John Connor, which is something that he feels he has to believe in order to pull off his performance, right? So that's why he freaks out. And that's a long way of saying that Leo and Christian Bale are both intense actors, and they both feel strongly about maintaining the idea that they are really, at least in these moments, that they are this person, even just from action to cut. And whatever they can do in those moments of action to keep themselves in that zone is something that they will do, you know, just because they feel that they are good at, and, you know, and we're just getting to Leo, like he wants to be the best actor that he can be. And whether or not the end product shows that he succeeded, he's going to do everything he can on set to keep his headspace exactly where he feels it needs to be for him to do the best job that he can. And that's something I respect. I think it's silly and doesn't add anything to the movie. Like, I don't get it because I have no desire to be an actor. But, you know, I respect that level of dedication to pretty much anything, even if it's something like acting.
Okay, and do you think he does all these things the exact same way if he knows there's no way anyone ever finds out? Like, I you're saying that this is about him getting in his headspace. Do you think that any – and I agree. Do you think any part of it is people will hear this and know that I am so committed to this and I'm a very serious actor and not a pretty boy, and this will up my chances of getting an Oscar?
I think he still would.
Okay. And I agree. I just didn't know if you thought any part of this was to, I mean, just because Titanic, which I know is like silly, and being a teen heartthrob and all these things.
And is a hardcore garbage movie.
Continue. Well, that's fine. Yeah. But
again, hardcore garbage, technical film term.
Yeah. I just mean, is any of this him trying to shake the image of being just a good-looking guy who gets in, you know, these movies? I mean, there's an argument. I mean, he was doing, you know, What's Eating Gilbert Grape and a lot of things that make him not, you know, clear that he's just riding his looks or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think Titanic is kind of the only movie you can point to. And I suppose Romeo and Juliet as well. But even in those choices, like, he's working with directors that, I mean, I don't think Baz Luhrmann was particularly well known at the time, but James Cameron certainly was.
Yeah.
It still falls into the whole him choosing to work with notable directors thing, even though he is still a pretty boy in those movies. And I bet if one were to do an appropriate amount of research, which I have not done, I bet we could find similar stories to this. Like, Leonardo demanded that the water in Titanic be cold as he fell away, you know, and to drowning or freezing to death or whatever happens to him at the end of that piece of shit. you know, I'm sure there are examples of that going as very far back into his career. You know, like, I would bet heavily on it. And I mean, he's a smart guy. He knows that this type of thing will contribute to his potential to win an Oscar. But I think the main thing to him in his head is that this will contribute to his ability to win an Oscar, because it will make him as good as possible. You know,
right? It's more about what is going to show up on the film,
exactly,
versus the story getting leaked to whatever magazine and being talked about.
Exactly. And I'm extremely cynical about those types of things in general. But like that, I don't know, that type of thing is.
But you believe he believes it?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. And on the notion of Oscars, you said a while ago that you are certain or pretty sure that he's going to win the Oscar for Best Actor this year?
It's happening.
100%.
I don't even know who else is in the category, but they shouldn't even show up. They should boycott the Oscars with Will Smith and Jada.
Okay, and can you explain why?
Well, okay, so I'm just looking up the other nominees for this year, just because I want to be sure I'm right. Okay, so Fassbender's not winning. Eddie Redmayne won last year. I don't know. Steve Jobs, I like Fassbender. He's a good actor. That movie wasn't good enough, and he wasn't good enough in it. Cranston, no fucking chance.
No one saw Trumbo?
Well, no one saw Trumbo, and the people that did see Trumbo were like, it's all right.
Well, B-Cran's got heat.
B-Cran does have heat, but I think the nomination is as far as that heat's going to carry him. And Matt Damon, I can't see him winning. So I think it's just like it's a combination of
maybe best actor in a comedy, but
yeah, exactly. I don't think it's insane for that movie to be qualified as a comedy. Like, it's pretty goddamn funny. Like, the things that are good in that movie is when Matt Damon is being funny. Anyway,
well, we'll do our Martian podcast after our Titanic podcast.
Oh,
so.
God, if the Martian wins Best Picture, we do a podcast on it. It's gonna be really upsetting for me. I really did not care for that film, for the listener at home. Except for Matt Damon, who I think is great in it. But anyway, I think it's a weak field this year. And
Well, no, it seems like they. I mean, how do you feel about the idea of him? I mean, there's just this sense that he really wants to win one, as we've discussed. I think they want to give him one because I think, as I said, he's a real, like, one of the few movie stars left. I mean, just the way that we kind of felt it for Scorsese before The Departed. Mm-hmm. And let's knock it on The Departed, because that's a whole other tangent as well. But it feels the same as it did that year, where it's like, hey, you know, he needs one, right? He's been so good and done so much. And it's just like, I just feel has played the game properly. And I don't think that's the biggest thing. I mean, awards really don't mean that much anyway. Mm-hmm. But he's just, you know, worked with the right people, done the right things, not talked shit, you know, been good, been mm-hmm. what I imagine the Academy would love for the face of the Best Actor award to be at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like his, like what we talked about, his filmography, it's not embarrassing ever. Like, you know, like even when he's in bad movies, it's you can see why he was in them, that type of thing. And right. It's not like I mean, Eddie Murphy, when he was famously nominated for an Oscar and that people thought he lost because Norbit came out around that same time, you know, like Leo doesn't have a Norbit, as much as I would love to see him star in Norbit too. But yeah, and it's just sort of like he has maintained this air of importance around him, and it's the Academy's going to give him an Oscar at some point, and it just feels like this year, with the things that he went through for the performance that have been well publicized, and we have talked about them, and the fact that it's a weak category this year.
Weak.
Yeah, and he's put in the time. Like, he's been nominated. I don't know how many times he's been nominated, but in the last 15 years, I mean, it's probably 3 or 4, right? If not more. Yeah, I don't know. He's earned it. In the Academy's eyes, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's cumulative and weak field, and I mean, do you think he's good in this movie? We haven't even talked about that.
Oh, I mean, he touched my soul like no actor ever has.
He looked right in my eyes, dude.
Yeah, me too. You had that too?
Yeah.
He's as good as Leo always is, you know, like he's fine. I know critics like him, and in general I tend to care about acting less than the average person. I don't get the Leo thing. I just don't. I thought he was really good in The Wolf of Wall Street, because I feel like that sort of played into the elements of Leo that I think he's very, like, he's just a super charismatic guy that doesn't tap into that very much. That was actually one of the things I liked about Matt Damon in The Martian as well, was that he was extremely charismatic in a way that he very rarely is, even though we all know he has that type of charisma.
And The Informant.
Well, no, The Informant, he's great in that movie. He's yeah. just so good in that movie. But also, Matt Damon's good in everything. Anyway, yeah, and that's sort of like my ideal. Leo is somebody that kind of plays into his more movie star aspects, like the star parts, you know, like as opposed yeah. to the craftsman. Because I don't know, you can just see him bleeding seriousness in this movie. And I don't know, he just never does it for me.
Okay.
Like, remember how worried I was when Inception came out that Leo was going to ruin the movie for me?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And with the exception of one line, he did fine.
Which line?
When he yells James and Philippa.
Okay, yeah, I thought so. Yeah. I was hoping you'd yell it is the only reason. okay, so I get what you're saying completely. This is me just wanting to have it verbalized. Can you say what it is about his performance versus Tom Hardy in this that separates the two? Because I think we both agreed Tom Hardy is fantastic in this and Leo's Leo. I mean, I know his name is Glass, but it's always Leo when I think about this movie in my head, whereas sometimes Tom Hardy is Fitzgerald to me, for narrative purposes and because that's who he was. Is it his life outside this movie or the performance, or what is it that separates something like that?
I don't know. I think because there's just some element of sameness to most of Leo's performances. And I don't quite know what it is. But I don't know. Like, I mean, specifically in this movie, there's a reservation to Leo. And obviously, I mean, he can't move for parts of this movie, so that's part of the job. But the reason Tom Hardy's so good in this and in general in his good performances is because he's so alive. We talked about that on Mad Max. Like, the way he moves, nobody else really moves like him. His sort of vocal stuff that he does, like he does a lot of like hems and haws that nobody else does. And I think on our Mad Max podcast, I suggested that it's part of being a recovered addict. Like he just always needs to be doing something instead of doing drugs, you know, like, and I think that has sort of played into his best roles, his constant movement. And he just sort of has this, but he also has that sort of like steely-eyed focus when the time comes. Like he, even when Donal Gleason is thinking of shooting Glass towards the beginning of The Revenant, and he ends up not doing it, obviously. Donal Gleason's the focus of the shot Tom Hardy's standing next to him. And I, too, have seen this movie two times, and I liked Donald Gleason. I don't spend a second of that shot looking at Donald Gleason. Like, Tom Hardy, there's just something about him that's so magnetic. And I can't explain anything other than the fact that he's got this, like, when he does choose to move, he does so in such, like, this alive, sort of odd way, or uncommon way, where he just feels very natural in the scene. And when he isn't moving, he still feels very natural in the scene and also incredibly focused on the scene that he exists in, you know? Whereas Leo, there's just always something about him that removes me, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. I get it too. Cause I also find my eyes just being drawn to Tom Hardy and like hearing his voice and his accents when the movie's done. So
yeah.
I am not going to argue against that at all. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up that scene, though, because I want to ask you how much of a villain Fitzgerald is in this. You know, he's seems to be the focus of, you know, the vengeance of what is arguably a revenge movie, you know. But you brought up that part where we almost get the captain shooting glass, you know, it's everyone's kind of given up on him.
Mm-hmm.
And the job that they're hired for is, you know, essentially wait till he's dead and then bury him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people talk about this movie, they say, you know, he was left for dead by his companions and then comes back. And even just the story in general, like the true story in general, he was left for dead by everybody, not just Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Fitzgerald kills his son, which obviously that is a huge deal, and I understand that. But they've given up on him, essentially. You know, mm-hmm. they don't walk away from him because there's this moral code in the frontier, which I think is something we want to talk about, too. But, you know, Fitzgerald has this guy, you know, he even says that we're not going to last much longer with if he keeps wailing like this. He's impeding the progress of the whole party, and they have, you know, all these natives around him that they're fearing will kill them shortly.
Mm-hmm.
He's slowing them down. Sometimes he's yelling, and people, you know, for the same reasons, he's mm-hmm. got all these villains around them who are, you know, intent on killing them, it seems.
Yeah.
He kills Hawk, so I know that. I know that that
is... No, that's... and even that Hawk, like, part of the reason he kills Hawk is because Hawk won't shut up, but there are still better ways to shut somebody up than murder. But yeah, what I see what you're getting at, and I agree. It's something I think about the movie, like, Fitzgerald's right, you know? Like...
I'm not describing this as a flaw of the movie. I wanted to know kind of how villainous he is.
He's villainous in that he didn't need to murder Hawk. I think his opinions on killing Glass, I think, are totally defensible. And like I said, I think he's right. Logically, he's right.
Yeah, it's almost as though that the captain not being able to kill him is a weakness of character.
Yeah.
You know, that's not him being an upstanding moral citizen. It's him not being strong enough to do something he believes is right for the other people because it might weigh heavy on his conscience.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, say you get attacked by a bear. I'd kill you, you know, like it's, I'd finally get to live out my dreams. But I do think,
listen to the, Inside Llewyn Davis podcast for more hypotheticals on my death and its effect on this podcast.
Yeah, you've got your regulation button spit off. I've got my dead James spit off. but no, like I think part of the reason that Fitzgerald is able to have that opinion is that it seems like he's been through, with the exception of maybe Glass, who is seemingly had his wife murdered, has been through the most, right? Like Fitzgerald has been scalped. He understands what can happen better than
exactly.
most people.
I think that scalping is kind of, you know, it's communicated in a lot of ways, but that is the visual signifier of I've seen some shit. I am going to do what needs to be done to protect me. You know, it's I will concede he robs the safe, which is another, very selfish act that clearly puts him in the bad guy category.
Yeah. Oh, and also, just while we're on the safe, I would love to point out the one shot that I absolutely adore in this movie when Donald Gleason goes up to the safe where,
And the dust comes through the roof.
yeah, that shot's amazing. And like,
Yeah.
just
There's
because
a
we also see Fitzgerald realizing that that's where the safe is. And I mean, it's just a gorgeous shot, but the combination of those things is wonderful.
No, absolutely. It's something that it looks good. The dust coming down looks good, but also is something that gets across the fact of I know exactly where the safe is. I would assume it's in his office. I could root around for a minute and figure it out, but that's something that achieves at least three things very quickly and very seamlessly. It's Fitzgerald has always kind of been thinking about fucking everybody over. It looks cool. I mean, we all saw Inception. Oh, we all saw Interstellar. We know how cool dust can look on film. It looks great. It does things narratively. It's Chekhov's safe. It's a bunch of very cool things. So yeah, I want to bring that scene up anyway.
But yeah, I Tom Hardy is or Fitzgerald is villainous to a point, but he's not entirely villainous, you know? Sometimes he's just being logical.
Yeah, and
Which can often make less emotional people seem more villainous than they are.
yeah, fair. And something else when we touched on the fight at the end, after Leo's kind of slid down the hill there and lost his rifle, and Fitzgerald just kind of turns his back on him and walks away. Like, the scene's not, it's not done. It's not going to be slowed down forever, but there's kind of this moment where it breathes, and they're both, they've both gone through some shit. Obviously, Glass has gone through more, especially recently, but that's a cool little lull in a good way where, there's been kind of this high tension stuff, very, violent and visual, and then there's kind of this little moment of it's not even comic relief, but it's just catch your breath. He's got his back turned to someone who he knows is going to kill him. And you just get some good, Tom Hardy acting face before things are going to ratchet up again. I thought that was a little moment where there's not that much to speak of, but that's part of constructing a really good sequence. And I thought that was done really well.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. What else?
Tom Hardy for president.
Tom Hardy for president. And Bernie Sanders is vice president.
And Killer Mike is their vice president.
Right. So is this a survival movie, revenge movie, action movie? All three?
I think it's all three. I don't think I think most people wouldn't classify it as an action movie just because there's not a ton of action, but it's an action movie. It's just an old-fashioned type of action movie, like it's an action movie from the 70s where it's,
Deliverance.
well, yeah, exactly. It is also a revenge movie. It's also a movie about learning about the problems of getting revenge. I think one of the things I like about this movie that is actually kind of like a meaning sort of thing is that it's a lot. You sit through this whole long movie to have the question, was it worth it, right? And specifically, was it worth it to survive to kill this person? It was maybe worth it to survive, right? But violence, it's just that the violence doesn't make things better is the end point of this movie that I like. And it's something that Fitzgerald calls out right before he dies. I mean, we brought up that line, it's not going to bring your boy back. Like, horrible things happen in the world. You doing more horrible things isn't going to make the world better, and that's something I like. I mean, we talked about that a lot with Looper, which I think is a movie that does that in a much stronger or gets that message across in a much stronger way. But I just in general am pretty much a pacifist, so the as frequently as I talk about wanting to murder you, like I enjoy that message in a movie, like and I think it's interesting, especially after everything that has come before it, all the things that all of the awful things that he has survived and a couple of the things that he has had to do to survive,
So. Yeah, there's a moment pretty late in the film before he gets back to the fort. He's in the cave and he scribbles or scratches "Fitzgerald killed my son" under the roof. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, is the narrative function of that just a reminder because there's been so much time and because we haven't had them interacting with each other?
Yeah, you know, it's. I really don't know. I don't have a take on that. I think I don't think it hurts the movie, but it certainly doesn't help the movie that it's there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because he's literally spelling out what he's doing.
Yeah. I just didn't know if that kind of being so blatant might bother you.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's not a very subtle movie with its messages in general. So I mean, it kind of fits. I mean, I guess I would be happier if it wasn't there. Like, I just don't understand why he's doing it. Like, who's he writing that for? Like, mm-hmm. if Fitzgerald killed your son, yeah, you're aware of that. You're the one writing this, you know? Like, and well, he's writing it in snow. The snow, by the time somebody is conceivably also running from bear attacks and hiding in that cave, it's the message is no longer there, you know?
Right.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, and... Yeah, I mean, just kind of dealing with the idea of it being a revenge movie. I mean, we're not supposed to like revenge. And as you said, it's something to take away from the ending. And some of the lines make it explicit is that, you know, it's not going to make things better. It's not going to bring your boy back, whatever. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the title, The Revenant? I mean, just this idea of... coming back, you know, what do you have a take on that? Just a word.
I'd say, I think it's a sort of like, I mean, it ties into the horrible final shot of the movie. The whole, like, I mean, the reason that he's supposed to look into the camera, or the reason that I think that he looks into the camera at the end, or what they were trying to get across, it was not to make me roll my eyes. It was they wanted it to be like, I did this, but you shouldn't sort of thing. Like, we can come back from being villainous or whatever. Like, we don't have to be murderers. Like, humanity has done all these horrible things, but we don't have to. We can change, you know, be the change you want to see in the world or whatever.
We can treat our natives better, Canada.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I mean, I think that's what it's supposed to be. But that's my take.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not exactly a hot take, but it's a take.
It's a take. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of this idea of hunting throughout the movie, too. I mean, in various degrees of how literal it is. I mean, it's all this entire movie seems to be set in action by the pelts, right? They're there to hunt the pelts. And I think something that kind of gets forgotten, all the, you know, captains and gunfights and forts and things like that, is that this isn't a military. Mm-hmm. This isn't let's go and kill all the natives and take their land. I mean, I imagine the natives probably see what's happening here as war. But this is commerce. Mm-hmm. This is for pelts. This is a financial thing for all the people involved. Mm-hmm. But I'm to get more to the hunting. I mean, we have people hunting for the pelts. We have people hunting for food. We have, you know, Leo hunting for Fitzgerald. There's a point where he's safe back at the fort and immediately turns around to go for Fitzgerald.
Yeah. I will say, I've talked a lot of shit about Leo. I like that scene where he's back at the fort and he's sitting shirtless talking to Donald Gleason. Like, I think he's very good in that scene for some reason. You know, like, okay. There's...
shirtless, got it.
Yeah, exactly. His intensity a lot of times hurts him to me, but in that sequence, I think it works perfectly. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, I'll agree to that.
Yeah.
No, it's just this... I mean, there's this hunting for Fitzgerald at that point. The natives are hunting for the one guy's daughter, which is, you know, ends up being important narratively. Mm-hmm. And then we have that shot of Leo with, you know, hunting the moose with his stick and, you know, pretending to shoot them. Did you have a take on that scene?
Hunting the moose with a stick. Oh, yeah.
You know, he's pretending it's a rifle and he pretends to take a shot and, you know, he's basically at a point he's weaponless and defenseless. So he's relying on, you know, salvageable meat. And this is... is this kind of just a fantasy moment of when he had power?
Yeah, exactly. My take is he's hungry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's pretty much it. At least in my eyes. I'm sure there was also something else that Mr. Inaritu wants me to think, but I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, along the same lines as what I mentioned about the natives hunting for, but looking to get their daughter back, which ends up being pretty important in the third act and the very final scene of this movie, is that Leo has saved her. She's been with the French all this time, despite all the violence between the natives against the Americans, assuming that they have her. Perhaps the distinction is not that important to them. What did you think of that? Just them being one of the two forces, you know, or three, I guess, Fitzgerald, nature, and these natives being our antagonists, essentially. You know, they've got a noble cause with the daughter, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, get your daughter back. Yeah,
right. Is that does that work for you for part of the trifecta of our forces to be worked against?
I don't know. I don't have a lot of thoughts about the use of indigenous people in the movie because I don't think there's enough of it to get across anything strong, so I am going to abstain from answering the question because I don't feel like I have an answer.
Okay,
yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah.
What about? I mean, it's been.
Do you have an answer for that?
Not overly. I mean, we have Leo's opinions on natives made mm-hmm. quite public, mm-hmm. Or not on natives, but on the treatment of them. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of negotiating how they're depicted as, you know, this, as I said, an antagonist, one of the main forces to be acted against. But Glass finds a way to get on their side and to agree with them. And obviously in the heat of battle, there's not much of a discussion of that. And then by the end of the movie, because of his, the strength of his character saving a woman earlier in the film for seemingly, you know, unnecessarily so. He mm-hmm. could have easily just taken one of their horses and gone as easily as he drew attention to himself mm-hmm. and, you know, stopped this rape from being committed. Just him being aligned with sort of these more positive values and, you know, where that puts him against the rest of his company. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously within that company, depending on what part of the movie and whose angle we're looking from, is either fine or horrible. You know, is Fitzgerald really the only negative element into it? You know, I would imagine that the Ree would say that all of these white people here are not welcome,
yeah,
at least.
White people are terrible.
Sure. Yeah. It's just, I think just because of Glass's condition, he kind of gets put outside of this, you know, big bad colonial machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then through, as I said, the strength of his character kind of gets put back in with, you know, the Ree, the natives, the land, all these kinds of things. And his understanding of nature and the earth and all these ways that he's able to survive for this long proves that he is part of it. And we also have the fact that his wife is Native and his child is, aligning him with those forces in that story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my only take, and I don't even think it's necessarily applicable to what you're talking about, other than the fact that, you know, we're talking about the same event, like him, saving the daughter, or at least, you know, rescuing her. I think that sort of can just also get across, like, always think about what you're doing, because at some point it could save your life, you know, or it could have meaning down the road, right? Yeah. And again, karma. Pardon?
Karma.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And or even in something like this where, you know, it's...
That's just karma in a very direct way.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah, just that, you know, there's always always ramifications for your actions in some capacity. Like, you always leave a footprint, you know? And if other people can see that footprint and remember that footprint, maybe one time when you're having a knife slash axe fight with Tom Hardy, they'll just walk by you instead of maybe kidnapping you or killing you or something.
As we all hope to do one day.
No, I don't. I would lose. but yeah, and I just think that that's one of the other things that I like, where he just sees something that he does not agree with. So even though he has to be violent to get out of that situation, he still sees injustice and he's going to fight against it in some capacity. And that ends up helping him, even though he did just commit a murder right before before that happens, you know. So again, the movie's kind of muddy, but there are some things in this movie that I think are good and certainly align on with my views on violence in general. So,
okay,
yeah.
Anything else about The Revenant?
I don't think so.
No, all right.
So let's just both stare directly. You set up a camera where you're recording as well, right?
Can we catch snowflakes on our tongue?
Let's do that for 30 seconds, and then we'll both just turn and stare at the camera.
And then a bit of breathing, and podcast done.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.